I was actually born in West Africa, and then we moved back to England. And the whole time I was a child, I would hear about these terrible famines in West Africa and how drought was causing famine. And so I really had an interest in and a fascination with natural disasters, even from when I was a kid, which is probably part of the reason I went to study geography. And then because I was interested in drought, and then this idea came along that we were actually changing the climate, then I naturally sort of transitioned from looking at climate extremes and disasters into something that seemed as though it was going to be much longer term.
And indeed it has been.
Mm-hmm.
And the news isn't good.
No. I mean, in terms of what we're doing to the climate, because we haven't reduced greenhouse gas emissions, the scenarios for what the future looks like.
That's globally,
globally.
In the U.S., we actually have.
Yeah, we've already, well, especially where I live in the Southwest, we're a hot spot for climate change. And the recent Southwest climate assessment that we produced at University of Arizona shows that in parts of the Southwest, we've already had sort of 3 degrees warming. And we're starting to see impacts on water supply and on ecosystems, especially those that are sitting on top of the sky islands on the mountains. But most of my work is actually in the developing world, in Latin America. And throughout Latin America, people are observing that things are already changing, like the glaciers retreating in the Andes, that sort of thing. So something that 20 years ago when I first started studying it was very hypothetical and based just on the models, we're now actually observing many of the scenarios coming true. And actually, because we haven't done much about the warming, the scenarios are looking worse.
It seems to me that there's been a shift in the last, say, 5 years from just talking about emission reductions to adaptation, to it's here, we have to adapt.
Yes. And I think that that is really important. And in fact, you can talk to people about adaptation who aren't willing to make the emission reductions, because I think that in some ways, we're not even well adapted to current climate variability. We haven't figured out how to completely cope with droughts and floods, even without a change in climate. And now we're seeing that with global warming, those extremes are getting greater. And things like Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, even though you can't tie them directly to global warming, they certainly send the signal that we need to do some adaptation. And in fact, with Hurricane Sandy, because Mayor Bloomberg and people in New York had thought about adaptation and they had a plan, the damages were actually much less than they might have been. And now throughout the West, we're seeing cities, federal agencies all starting to think about climate adaptation, partly because it makes sense anyway, but also because they're seeing that we're not doing much to control the emissions and warming. So we've actually got a climate adaptation center at the University of Arizona and are working with a lot of different agencies and NGOs and even private businesses on this issue of adaptation.
So do you think it's much easier to talk with people about adaptation than it is to talk with them about who's causing climate change and what we should do about that?
Well, in some cases, yes, because for a long time, the debate was whether the Earth was warming or not. Now, most people seem to accept that it's warming, but they don't necessarily accept that it's human-caused. And then the big debates, of course, are about the solutions. But because most people do think it's warming, you can talk about how we need to adapt to the warming without actually talking about emission reductions. But for me, you have to talk about both. And, you know, one of the things I talked about in my lecture here last night is this sort of contradiction where, as poverty is being eliminated around the world, and I talked a lot actually about the good news on development, about how we've really cut the number of people in poverty, we've given people access to water. The irony is that as people come out of poverty, they use more energy, and that's pushing the emissions up even further. So we've got this circle between emissions and adaptation, and we've got to address both.
The fossil fuel industry, for example, would argue that if you're going to bring people out of poverty, you've got to continue burning fossil fuels. They need that energy resource, for example, in China, which is desperately trying to raise the standard of living and is succeeding in that in China. It's in part because they have so much coal to burn.
Yes, and it's very hard to tell people that you cannot burn your coal when we, of course, have developed our economy based on coal. And even within this country, some of the poorest populations are those that are either work from coal or benefit from living in coal regions. So in Arizona, for example, we have really some of the largest electric plants that are emitting greenhouse gases in the whole U.S. And they're on the Navajo reservation, and the Navajos are making good wages, good income, good jobs. So talking about closing down coal in Arizona and New Mexico is a very hard thing to do.
And the Crow Reservation in Montana, for example, sees coal as an economic boost.
Yeah.
As well.
So I think there are things that can be done in terms of making sure that that energy is used extremely efficiently so that the emissions per unit of energy are as low as possible. But I also think we need to do the research on carbon sequestration. Can we take those gases out of the air and put them somewhere safe so that they won't warm the atmosphere? But we're not really there that either both technologically and economically. But the other thing to do is China and the Navajo are both thinking beyond carbon. So China's investing massively in renewables.
They have no choice. They can't breathe
right?
at this point.
Well, that's one of the things that's pushing them. It's not the greenhouse gases, it's the air pollution. And again, the Navajo have plans to retire their plant in stop the lease in 2040, and they're already looking at whether they can use solar to provide the same sort of financial and jobs on the reservation. But I think we are going to go through what I think of as peak warming. And so I think a lot of the challenge is how do we transition through that period where we are going to be warmer as we shift out of coal. And I think we can do that in a lot of places with water reuse, but it's the ecosystems that are going to have the toughest time.
One of the dire predictions of the impacts of climate change is that there will be millions of so-called climate refugees, mm-hmm. that people in the less developed part of the world, especially in coastal areas, are going to be massively displaced, and that will be one of the impacts we have to, quote, adapt to.
Yes, that's actually interesting you raise that, because I'm quite critical of some of the people who really exaggerate the risk of both climate refugees and also that climate's going to cause wars between countries. I think at the moment there are a few climate refugees, but even in some cases, those people are happy to move if they get adaptation assistance. I mean, we are going to have to deal, if we don't do something about warming, with the coastal cities of the world. But it's whether those people are refugees or whether we plan for relocation. So as you get a Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Haiyan, are we actually going to rebuild in the same places or use the disaster recovery to move people away from the coast into less vulnerable areas? And I think we have to ask the question, what are the limits to adaptation in place? Because certainly the Dutch can tell us all about how to live with a higher sea level, for example.
By building huge seawalls.
Yeah, and other sort of adaptations, like they actually have some floating communities, that sort of thing. But then there's going to be a trigger point where we actually have to think about relocating back from the coast. But in the sort of climate and conflict area, there's been quite a lot of, oh, climate change is going to cause conflict. But I would argue that we really haven't got the evidence for that. And in some cases, environmental stress might promote more cooperation than conflict. And there are people who've worked on water stress, for example, who suggest that you're more likely to get water cooperation than water wars when you have these highly stressed environments.
You met with the Dalai Lama about climate change.
Yes.
You were one of 10 scientists who were invited to speak with him. That must have been quite an experience.
Well, it was an experience and it was an honor. And we spent a whole week with him in Dharamsala. And he's extremely concerned about climate change because Tibet, of course, is a hot spot, and it's also what they call the water tower of Asia. So they're worried about everything that happens with all the rivers that come out of the Tibetan plateau. But one of the things that was wonderful about spending time with him and a lot of his monks who are very interested in science is that the Dalai Lama loves science. He's completely fascinated by science. And people kept wanting him to talk about more spiritual and ethical issues. And he kept wanting to talk about the science. And it was fascinating. He asked a lot of questions and very thoughtful questions. And then it's been interesting because we did the seminar a couple of years ago. And then since then, his last tour of North America, he talked a lot about climate change. And he sees it as a sort of an intergenerational issue and an ethical issue.
Which it is.
It is. It is. And when you have the spiritual leaders taking these environmental issues seriously, I think it's really important. One of my former students, Catherine Wilkinson, wrote a book on evangelical Christianity and climate stewardship, which came out recently. And she did focus groups all over the South. And there's this idea that certain people don't care about climate change. She found people care deeply about what we're doing to the environment. They see it as a religious obligation to care for the environment. So I really think that it's very important to think about climate change in terms of the world's major religions and also in terms of the arts and humanities, for example.
There's no way you could have known 30 years ago that it would be the issue it has become, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's sometimes, I sometimes almost feel a little overwhelmed by it, because when I started studying it, it was just sort of an intellectual interest, a fascination. Let's play with these models and see what I can find out. And now it's like the future of the planet. But it also, sometimes I get almost tired of how prevalent climate change is and how we keep having to say the same things and we keep having the same debates. And I want to go off and study something else like wildlife in Yellowstone, which, well, of course, will be affected by climate change.
There's no escape.
Yeah.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Diana Liverman. She is a geography professor at the University of Arizona and co-director of the Institute of the Environment there and a well-known environmental scholar. Dr. Liverman, pleasure to have you in our studio to talk about this important topic. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to visit Montana. I hadn't been here before, and I'll be back.